pastor is all the demographic membership data that the church has. The church has this data of church membership and participation that I would argue is unrivaled in the globe in terms of religious participation. I mean, they know how many people are participating. They know the likelihood of, you know, correlating sacrament attendance to temple participation. And, of course, we'll never see that data. And so the people who know, you know, whether there is a cliff of participation of people leaving is a church that I don't think we'll ever know. What we do know is the church is worried about it. I mean, at the very least, we have those leaked videos from 2008 of someone presenting to church leaders in Salt Lake City. I think it was Mormon Leaks, or someone leaked these videos, where they gave a data something like 35% of Mormons between the ages of 23 and 29 were active. Right? Something startling. So I think at the very least we know that church leaders are worried about that. We have some fragmented ideas. So for instance, the Pew Research poll of religious participation in America, which is one of the best sources we have for religious affiliation, but it's still, you know, spotty. In 2012, said that 2.8% of Americans identified as Latter-day Saints. Last year, they did the same poll with the same question, and it was down to 1.9. Now, there's a margin of error there, right? There's a huge margin of error. But if we were to take those numbers as accurate, that would be a loss of something like 2 million Mormons, numbers-wise, in America. Now, again, take that with a grain of salt because there's a huge margin of error there. So the answer is, I don't know. I think we can at least be safe assume that church leaders are worried about retention numbers right now, and they're trying to do things that they feel push it. For instance, I think that the major temple construction project right now is due to a number of things, like what are we going to do with all this money, but also, and I could go into that more too, but like, it's also, I think they believe that the answer to the loss of retention is committing more people to temple participation, because to have a temple in your neighborhood, that means you have to have temple workers, you have to have temple attendants to be temple workers, temple attendants, you have to be tithe payers to be tithe payers, you have to have active, and I think that's the way they see as one of the ways to confront that issue. So the answer is I don't know the truth. I wish I did. But I think it's safe to say that there is decreasing participation levels in America. I think we all have we don't have the data, but we all have the anecdata. Right, in our local congregations, and I think we could all give examples of that. But the full extent of that, we're just making educated guesses. Yeah, Bob.
Hey Ben, you said something a minute ago. I'm looking forward to reading the book, but
thank you. Let's cut it off there.
Okay. But you said something about, you know, us getting in with the Christian Coalition in the '80s. I see that as sort of a direct line coming out of the Birchers. Birch Society playing where we are now?
That's a great question. So, and I would even take it back further. I think J. Reuben Clark is laying those seeds in the 1930s. Because J. Reuben Clark, and this is another segue that I promise I'm going to get to the point. J. Reuben Clark joins the First Presidency in 1933. He attends his first general conference, and he is aghast that several members of church authorities, including the presiding bishop and Amy Brown Lyman, who wasn't the president of the Relief Society, but was the driving force of the Relief Society, both get up to the general conference pulpit, and they praise FDR's New Deal. And J. Reuben Clark, as a lifelong devoted Republican partisan, is gobsmacked by this. And he ends up having a meeting with church leaders, Relief Society leaders, priesthood leaders, and he asks them, what will it take to get the Latter-day Saints off of welfare? And they get certain numbers. And one of the people in attendance, we have this record at the University of Utah, one of the people in attendance writes across the agenda for that meeting, this amount of aid would bankrupt us. And so J. Reuben Clark starts in that time that the goal to wean Mormons both off of welfare and away from the Republican Party, or from the Democratic Party toward the Republican Party. And that's a slow process that takes several decades. Over the next three elections, Clark writes, under the masthead of the First Presidency, editorials in the Deseret News, telling the Saints to vote against FDR, that he's the devil. And every time, the Latter-day Saints vote for FDR. but he laid the groundwork. There's a wonderful memoir written by James Moyle, who was a prominent Mormon Democrat from the 70s, and he actually served in FDR's administration. And he writes a memoir a few years later, and he says, what Clark and others are doing, it hasn't worked yet, but it's going to be slowly moving the saints toward the Republican Party. They removed the entire Deseret News masthead and replaced them with Republican leaning people. They start framing church curriculum around Republican talking points. This is the period where we redefine the law of consecration in Mormon memory to not be a communitarian endeavor. And then Ezra Benson and Cleon Skousen and others build on that foundation. They start offering a vision of Mormonism that is more in accordance with conservative politics and conservative ideals. And in a way, some of them are embraced by the broader nation. I think there's still a story to be told about how Cleon Skousen builds inroads with the religious right as way back in the 1960s and 1970s. But it's not until the 1970s and 1980s that the Mormons prove their worth to the religious right. Because they do that not just through their words, which they've been doing for a few decades, but they do that through their action, especially their opposition to the Equal Rights Amendment. And once they prove their worth to the religious right, then the religious right are willing to adopt them. So we even have, like, Jerry Falwell being told, and it could have gone otherwise, because many of you might be aware of, like, the rise of anti-Mormon, like, cult rhetoric that takes place in the 1970s and 1980s with, like, the God Makers, right? Which is seen by 1 million people a month in the early 1980s, because it's this rise of counter-cult, anti-cult rhetoric and evangelicalism prompted by, you know, like, Jim Jones and all of that. And so it would have been very possible that the evangelicals wouldn't have held hands with the Mormons because they still see them as heretics. But Jerry Falwell goes, hang on, maybe the Mormons can be useful. So he actually refuses to play the Godmakers on his Christian television station. They invite Ezra Benson to serve on the board of the Moral Majority. And so I think it was through proving, and there's of course these other cultural appendages that's attached to that, where the church realizes that if they are going to form this alliance, they're going to have to package the faith certain ways. We're going to change the logo of the church to emphasize Jesus Christ more than everything else, to emphasize our Christian. We're gonna add a subtitle of the Book of Mormon as another testament of Jesus Christ. And we're going to downplay our unique historical origins, like polygamy and other things, which is a context that I think often gets overlooked when we talk about the fights over history with Arrington's Camelot and stuff. That one of the things that made historians so troublesome during the 1970s and 1980s were they going to ruin this whole pact that we're moving toward. And so that's why I think it's the 1970s and 1980s that you see the fruition of seeds that are being planted decades earlier. Yeah, Ivana.
The ordained women movement.
So,
and then they're followed by the
church. Yes, so the question of women's ordination. That was one of the through lines that I tried to trace from the very beginning of the book. Joseph Smith dictates a revelation that comes to be known as DNC 25 in response to Emma Smith. We often see that as, you know, the first revelation written in response to a woman, and it talks about the woman's role. I think it's also important to note that, like, it wasn't foreordained that only men were going to be ordained to the priesthood in the 1830s. What the role of women would be in religious organizations was up in the air. There were some religious movements that were allowing women to serve as quasi-ministers. And so Joseph Smith dictates a revelation that allows Emma Smith to be an extorter of scripture. Right? Language that was borrowed, by the way, from Methodists at the same time when they're trying to decipher what the role of women is going to be. You have Eliza R. Snow, who's often meditating on the relationship of women to priesthood authority, rejecting modernist reformers, but also not moving to call toward, you know, women holding priesthood. And it's also important to remember, as Jonathan Stakely would probably tell you, the definition of priesthood itself was evolving throughout all these years. I was struck, as someone who, you know, as everyone in this room lived through the ordained women movement and the backlash in the 20-teens, how much it was a repeat of previous decades of fighting over the same types of issues. Dialogue and Sunstone and Exponent in the 1980s were raising issues of women ordination that in some ways were more radical than what we're still seeing today. And that also caused a backlash. I don't think we would have seen the September 6 excommunications and disciplines if it weren't for the feminist context of those agitation scholars during that decade, by the way. So when Kay Kelly and the Ordained Women movement caused this question of the role of women again, they're building in a long tradition that goes back, and church leaders were also drawing from 200 years of reserves of how to respond to that. This was not the first time that a woman was excommunicated for pushing for women's ordination, right? So I think it shows the constant, the cyclical nature of these debates over women's feminism, because you see these moments of massive unrest and kind of backlash that is then followed by a fallow period where things subside to the point to where after the tense decade of the 1980s, the excommunications and disciplines of the 1990s, we get to the point of 2002 when Peggy Fletcher Stack writes an article in the Salt Lake Tribune saying, where have all the Mormon feminists gone? And so it's cyclical. You see these pushings, you see the retrenchment, and often they fit in the broader context too, because in the 1980s when you get the women's priesthood scholarship, that's at the same time that you get second wave feminism doing the same thing in all these other contexts. You have some religious denominations who approve women preachers and pastors in the 1960s and 1970s, and it seemed destined that a lot of American religions were going to do the same. And then guess what? Many denominations have backlashes in the 1980s. The Baptists step back on women's ordination. The Anglicans end up having a schism over it. And so I think you can both see the cyclical nature within the Mormon tradition as well as the broader context in which these people are, you know, holding hands with other agitators. Other questions? Let's see. How are we doing on time? We're great. Yeah.
You mentioned one of the themes you're exploring are the contingencies.
Yeah.
Can you comment on a couple of the favorite counterfactual contingencies? Unless you prefer to talk about all that money.
Well, the money is always fun. I'll point to one contingent period, and it's one that I kind of touched on earlier today, the J. Reuben Clark moment. I really believe that 1938 was a hinge point of Mormonism, because up until that point, you had several potential trajectories of the faith. You have those who are pushing for Latter-day Saints to be more incorporated in mainstream modernist scholarship. You are those who are pushing for democratic politics. You are those who are pushing for more women's activism or women's role in the public sphere. And one of the reasons that J. Reuben Clark tries to crash down on all of them in between 1933 and 1938 is because he feared that those trajectories were winning. I mean, he could look at BYU and see the BYU religion department in the 1930s didn't teach any courses on the Book of Mormon. They were teaching courses on religion and evolution, or religion and psychology. There was a poll that was done at BYU in 1935 that found that only 38% of students believed there was a literal devil, or that 34% believed that humans were the product of organic evolution. Like, something that would have made Joseph Fielding Smith gasp, right? And so he kind of cuts down on all of those and leads on other trajectories. I think other moments, the late 1880s, that was a period that really struck me while I was writing the book, where I don't think we fully grasp the consequences that between 1885 and 1890, a majority of church leadership were fugitives from the law. Right? Living on the underground means not like they were hiding from, they all had, you know, indictments against them. And they're on the run. There, it was possible that the LDS church could have become similar to something like we see the FLDS church today, right? Where church leaders are constantly on the run, constantly on the underground. And making decisions to remain an incorporated public church was a crucial move. I mean, you can even point to some contingent trajectories all the way back into 1831. I was 1831 because I was worried how much am I going to be stretching to find these through lines throughout. In 1830 to 1831, you have debates over the place of women, the place of intellectual and religious individualism with Hiram Page Thearstone, the place, the question of racial equality with Black Pete, a Black member in Kirtland who was considered one of the leaders of the congregation and then eventually falls away. Issues of indigenous missions and the role of women. All of those trends you find all the way in the early 1831. And just because the church goes one direction didn't mean those other directions were possible. So those are just a few examples. All right. Yeah, on the church.
In your book, you touch on like the Clark Gilbert, his tenure as...
Yeah. Not really. I fear some of it gets a bit too in the weeds for like, and like the most recent like 5 years, it's so recent I have a hard time like making statements. I did, some of you might have saw a Salt Lake Tribune essay of mine that went up this week that connected J. Reuben Clark to Clark Gilbert and like the two Clarks of Mormonism. I'm kind of jealous I didn't think of that phrase myself. But I think if, at the very least, I tried to explain the context that makes it possible for someone like Clark Gilbert to push a number of policies. Yeah?
So, do you have any comments or thoughts on the LDS Church's emphatic insistence that the heavens are open? And we've got this channel for New Canada.
Yeah.
And in the modern times, they don't use it. Whereas, in the world is full of perplexity, conflicts that couldn't be more riven.
Right.
We could use it about now. Right. Did you learn anything in your research about that?
No, only that, I mean, I wish I could have a stronger take on that. Only that shift happens very early in Mormonism. I mean, by 1833, Joseph Smith is leaning more on council decisions than individual revelations pushing. Like, that's not total. I mean, there are some doctrines that are introduced later on that are not made by council. But I think there's a sense of stability that comes from my idea of having logical consequences and movements in the church and decisions being made that way, as opposed to a thus saith the Lord revelation. But what I can say, and what I try to dig into the church, is that you have members who are uncomfortable with that shift from the 1830s. You already have members who are critiquing church leaders for not following, for not having a prophetic voice in times of cultural crisis, and as a result, starting their own breakoff group. And so the fact that now we can have a Denver snuffer figure who can get a large following because he says, hey, here's my book of Revelations, let me compare it to yours. And you have thousands that follow that. That shows the power of this kind of precedent that's in the Mormon tradition, that when you're founded by someone who asks God for a revelation and receives that, and that gives you the authority to dismiss everyone else and start your own trajectory, that's always going to be replicated.
So quick follow-up.
Yeah.
Was common consent also, did it meet its demise early? Or did it evolve away?
Yeah, I mean, you're not seeing robust debate over common consent in the LDS tradition. After novel. You had a question here.
Yeah. One of the things that just completely blows my mind is how we've been able to redefine the Mormon concept of family to be the nuclear family unit.
Yeah.
Even our history, that's the audacity.
Right,
it's really quite shocking. And as we have tried to set up alliances with different groups, what kind of tensions are you seeing emerge there?
So first of all, you can point to a very a cultural moment where that nuclear family emphasis comes. It comes from the post-World War II era when all of America is turning toward the nuclear family. There's a great book that argues that the traditional family is created by the new capitalist society that comes out of the post-World War II economic boom. And so many religious traditions turn to the family as the nucleus of their belief. And Mormonism buys that whole handle. And they embrace this notion of the family to the point to where when that notion of the family then becomes a divisive topic in the 1970s, it's like finally arriving in the party right when it's breaking up. Right? That's kind of what the Mormons do with the family there. And of course, it requires a rereading of the past. It's kind of one of my favorite anecdotes of that is Leonard Arrington, who is a church historian, is asked by the Ensign to write an essay on Brigham Young's family. And they said, but don't mention polygamy. Right. And then you have the priesthood and Levite manuals. It was like, Brigham Young marries Miriam Workham in 1835, and that was his last marriage. Right? So it takes a reframing, because even after polygamy kind of subsides after 1890, you get multiple types of family structures, the intergenerational families, the kind of communal groups together is still dominant, and you can almost trace through the rise of like the discussion of the nuclear family during that time, and the commitment to that has meant prioritizing that over some other things. And what I'll also emphasize is like that idea had always been a myth. I mean, scholars have pointed to that at the very moment that religions had started emphasizing the nuclear family, with especially a husband and a stay-at-home and wife and children, was at the very moment that that became a fiction in society. That you have a majority of working mothers, you have a growing number of single parents, that the emphasis on the family is not because it is the common denominator in society, but it is a backlash because it's not. In the way back, Cynthia.
Did you address any of the issues through this whole time period with indigenous people?
Absolutely. I try to make it a goal not just to discuss Mormon views of indigeneity, but I tried to always incorporate the voice of indigenous peoples in that story. And further, there is a unfortunate trend of scholars, including religious scholars, who end up perpetuating the vanishing Indian myth, to where you'll discuss Native Americans up until the point of colonization of Western expansion, and then they don't get discussed in the 20th century because they're not there anymore, right? There is a recent huge history of America that was a New York Times bestseller, and not a single indigenous person is named after 1890. So I made a concerted effort, and I probably could have done better, but I did make a concerted effort to not only discuss indigenous Mormon issues throughout the 20th century to the present, but that every chapter after 1945 on includes indigenous voices within the chapter. Yeah, Mike.
We're here tonight because of this book of yours, and that's what draws me here, and I hope this isn't a deflection from the wonderful discussion of Mormon history.
Sure.
But I love you as a prose stylist, and your readings of a few paragraphs there were just elegant examples of that. It's not common among historians. I mean, it's a lot of what
my students agree.
I wonder if you could comment on your literary roots.
Sure.
Not in Mormon history,
but
just your literary roots, because I just think it's what brought me out here to buy the book, because I'm interested in what you have to say, but the way you say it is really beautiful to me.
Well, thank you.
Aside from your teaching, as a teacher here, I've been loving that experience, but you as a prose stylist and the way you construct sentences, paragraphs, and beyond.
Well, thank you. That's very, very kind, and it's a compliment that I don't take lightly. I think it's important to recognize when you're trying to write to different audiences, you have to take different styles. Right, because I'm one that actually celebrates some historians who get into the jargony like type of things that no one can read outside when they're writing for other historians, right? But if you want, and that's great, I have a book that's been read by dozens of people that is written in an academic lexicon that like requires a buy-in to understand. But if you want to write for a general public, you have to write in a way that the general public reads. And I had a big learning experience when I wrote Kingdom of Nauvoo, and I'm like, I know how to write for a general audience. And I wrote a draft, and I sent it off to my editor, a guy by the name of Bob Weil, who's phenomenal. And he sent back my first draft with red in every single line. And it's like, and it wasn't just content things, and I could go into like what he said about polygamy that, you know, helped me understand. But like stylistically, so I'll give one example. He said, you have to remove 70% of your quotations.
Yeah.
Which is hard for a historian.
Yeah.
Because as the kids say, those are my receipts. Do the kids still say that? I don't know. Like, I want to show my evidence, right? Especially all of you who write, you know how great it is when you find a juicy quote and you want to share it. Right? But if you want to write a narrative, it has to stay in your voice.
Yeah.
It has to move along. Every chapter, my editor gave me the great advice, every chapter has to be a short story.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
There has to be a narrative arc. There has to be character development. You have to, and especially the phrase that I kept on hearing over and over again on this book specifically is, take out all the potted history, or the potted context.
Mm-hmm.
That sometimes I'm like, all right, now I have to talk about World War II.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you can only talk about this stuff if you weave it into the narrative.
Yeah.
Which means it has to be a light touch. Which means, like, when I think I have a great historiographical intervention where I can finally prove this specific thing, I'm like, all right, either move that direct historical intervention into the footnote,
mm-hmm.
or you have to emphasize the character of what's going on here. So, yeah.
I'll just make this a footnote for that. I just was reviewing a manuscript for a publisher, and I came up with this. I said, you have to, for this author,
yes.
you have to move from, let me tell you everything I've earned the right to say,
right.
to, you've got to hear this story.
Yeah, it's a show don't tell.
Yeah,
you have to. Yeah, I could tell you that modernism was a driving ideological force in the 1920s.
Yeah,
but it's a lot better to show it through
yeah.
Experience in the 90s. So, actually, there's a hand right in front of Mike too. But yeah, go for it.
Yeah, to my mind, in the mid-20th century, two of the most important books in LDS thought are Joseph Fielding Smith's Man's Destiny
yep.
and then Bruce R. McConaughey's Mormon Doctrine.
Yeah.
And both of those raise the prophet's ire. I mean, there's
right.
a lot of consternation attached to them.
Right.
Yet both of those books end up defining what orthodoxy is.
Right.
So how is it that conservative dissenters, for lack of a better term, can use the levers of power to
right.
create their orthodoxy?
Yeah, it's a great question. I have a great anecdote in this book when you guys know the swearing elders at the University of Utah, these
mm-hmm.
Utah professors who would get together and debate Mormon topics. There was one meeting where they were debating Joseph Fielding Smith's Man, His Origin, and Destiny,
mm-hmm.
and Bruce R. McConkey showed up. And after the meeting had gone on, and those of you, of course, know that Bruce R. McConkey is Joseph Fielding Smith's son-in-law. After the debate goes on long, Bruce R. McConkey stands up, fully exceeds the two-minute allotment for responses. And finally, Sterling McMurrin stands up and says, your time is over. Sit down and shut up. And then Sterling McMurrin turns to his grad student and says, you need to write up this account because this is the only time I've been able to tell a general authority to sit down and shut up. And I doubt I'll ever get it again. And that book, so Man, His Origin, and Destiny, causes a kind of crisis among a lot of Mormon intellectuals where they're like, do we have to buy into these ideas? Is this what it means to be Mormon? And David O. McKay meets or receives letters from a lot of these people, and David O. McKay says, no, that's his personal idea, yada, yada, yada. And then Bruce R. McConkey takes it to the next level with Mormon Doctrine. Those of you who haven't read the story of the reaction to Mormon Doctrine, do so, because it's fascinating. I mean, they get an apostolic committee to read through. They find something like 1,500 errors in their view. They take it off the shelves. And I truly believe that it's Mormon Doctrine that is the final the final domino to fall that leads to the correlation movement.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So I really think it's Mormon Doctrine that finally gets people to agree to a correlation movement that we have to grow. It's not the liberal voices. It was Bruce R. McConkey. Because liberal voices always frame their ideas as a hypothesis because they know they can get in trouble for it, right? They always frame their messages kind of counter-cultural. Whereas the conservatives back there said, this is doctrine, right? Mormon doctrine. I think those books end up being influential, A, because they have kind of a prophetic or apostolic impromptu that's placed on them later, but also they're the last voices before the correlation movement. And Bruce R. McConkie knows how, even after Mormon doctrine gets taken off the shelf, he knows how to maneuver to get it back on the shelves a decade later. And so I think there's, so for instance, on politics, also a cause for a correlation was Ezra Benson's political speeches over the pulpit. But the fact that his voice rang last and rang the loudest is going to have the lasting legacies. Because it's one thing to start the correlation movement. It's another thing to then denounce those previous teachings. And because they don't take that step, the problems arise. Yeah?
Kind of a follow-up to that. How do you think, what will be the lasting legacy of the difference of opinions between President Inkley and President Nelson?
It's a good question. It's a good question. And by the way, those of you who are keen readers might find some interplay between Nelson and Hinckley in this book in certain sections. I think that Nelson's changes are at least going to be lasting because he understands the power of organizational entrenchment.